Hello and welcome to Talking Property with CBRE, a podcast in which our team of experts share their commercial real estate insights. My name is Bradley Spears. I'm Head of Research for CBRE in Australia, and I'm your host for today's episode. Over the next little bit, we'll be talking about findings contained in a report produced by the Australia and New Zealand research teams. The report is titled Building Resilience into Real Estate Post-2020. I'm joined by members of CBRE's Pacific team, Kate Bailey, who's our Head of Retail and Logistics Research in Australia, Gergay Gaspardi, who covers New Zealand office markets, and Tamba Carlton, who is a residential and BTR specialist in New Zealand. The report covers four themes, and the first of those themes that we'll be exploring is around time savings. COVID lockdown has resulted in white-collar employees working from home. Numerous surveys across the globe have indicated that employees have enjoyed the fact that this has saved them time in commuting. Looking ahead, we're expecting a gradual shift to people increasingly working from home. A question for you, Gergay. Does more people working from home represent a threat to office demand and something that landlords should be concerned about?
Good question, Bradley. I think demand for office space is likely to be soft in the short term. And there are multiple reasons for that. One is obviously a cyclical reason. That is a typical trend in economic downturns and when there's uncertainty. And that's underpinned by our surveys, which show that the vast majority of occupiers think that their portfolio will decrease, even if only slightly in some instances. But there's also the structural reason that you mentioned, the more people working from home or working flexibly, which is, again, also expected by their employers. And that is also underpinned by a survey which shows that support for working from home in a more formalized manner is high on the agenda for occupiers. But it's obviously not for everyone. And we also understand that analysis around the growth in productivity might be short-term, typically driven by fear and anxiety at the beginning of lockdowns, whereas in a longer term, that might change and bite into that productivity. Some of the Asian reports that have been recently published indicate that there's a push for employees to return to the office by their employers. And anecdotal evidence does exist in New Zealand as well that some businesses do want their employees to return. So I think it will be interesting to see how this will pan out in the future. But more than ever, I think what is important is to create a space where employees will want to be. And if that is the case, then employees will want to come to the office because they will know that that's the best place for them to do their work. And that leads us to your question, Bradley. So I don't think that landlords should be worried. They should be looking at how their tenants use their space and help their tenants to create spaces that their employees will like and will want to come to.
Great. Thank you, Gugge. A question to you, Tamba. Look, feedback that we're receiving from clients and indeed survey results that we've also viewed indicate that more employees will want to work from home. And 2 or 3 days a week seems to be that sweet spot. If there are more people working from home, what does that mean for the residential sector in terms of demand from a locational standpoint?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different impacts that working from home have. But I think it's important to know that working from home isn't going to be the same experience for every employee. So there are some people that are willing and able to work from home, and there are other people that are not willing and not able to work from home. So that 2 to 3 days is an average across the entire employment market, but it's very specific to each person and individual roles as well. So basically, to answer your question, what it means for developers is increased opportunity. So rather than being confined to locations centered around employment nodes, if people are willing and able to work from home, that opens up those locations for more intensive residential development, where previously that might not have been possible because it might have been too far from employment. So the benefit of that is that it's likely to be areas with lower land values, and that will enable more affordable housing to be built. In the Auckland context, some of these town centres on the outskirts of the region are the likes of Drury, Warkworth and Pukekohe. Up until this point, traffic has made living in those locations really hard if you don't work locally, because they might be more affordable in terms of house prices, but the transport cost and the cost of time is really high. If we think about the ideal living situation as a 15 or 20 minute city, so your home, your work, your favorite bar, your favorite cafe, all of these are within 15 to 20 minutes. These outskirt cities are now part of that if you can work from home. Another benefit is less reliance on transport connectivity. So a smaller commute, effectively none if you're working from home, but if you're not spending an hour and a half on the motorway or an hour and a half on the train or bus, that's got benefits for emissions. If we think about fewer people using those resources, that means there's probably no justification for investment in them. So that's a bit of a counterbalancing, but overall the climate benefits are quite significant.
And what about in terms of residential building design? Are we going to start to see houses with two studies so that two partners can be working at home at the same time?
Well, I mean, it's possible, but you have to think about more flexibility rather than a set study. So houses should be flexible to suit changing needs of a household. For one week, it might be a study. For another week, it might be a guest room. For another week, it might be something else entirely, or storage. So the other thing with working from home is that living and working in the same place can be quite tiring and lonely. So what potentially could be an opportunity is separate but close by local working space where you can get ready at home, leave your home and go to the office, which may be less than a 5 minute walk away, and then do your work. And it's got that mental separation of I'm at work versus I'm at home. Because if you're working and living in the same space, I mean, we all experienced it with lockdown, right? It just blends into one monotonous time and it's quite draining for your mental health. So I think houses will be more flexible in their design, but in terms of working from every home, it may not be ideal.
And Kate, in the retail sector, if there are more people working from home, what is that going to mean?
Yeah, Bradley, what it really does is it just changes everybody's night trail. And if you think about your normal week of spend, you might get up in the morning, have a coffee at the train station, go out for lunch when you're at work, get a sandwich, buy a birthday present, Friday night drinks. All of a sudden, that spend won't go away. It might just move back to your local area, which is great because, you know, we've seen vacancies start to creep up in our suburban shopping strips for some time now, and this could really plug a whole lot of money back into them and really increase vibrancy as well.
And while we're talking about retail, people have also saved a lot more time shopping this year, with online retail sales increasing as people went into lockdown. Supermarkets in particular saw online sales increase, coming off a low base compared to other forms of retail. It's likely that many of those that made the shift to online grocery will continue to use that option. Kate, what impact do you see this trend in higher levels of e-commerce having on retail logistics and things like cold storage?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Bradley. I mean, grocery online retail has always been the most challenging part of e-commerce and has always, I guess, suffered a little bit and hasn't seen the same exponential growth we've seen in other parts of the retail sector over the past few years. But lockdown really drove a lot of new customers towards, you know, shopping online. An example of that is, you know, my 94-year-old grandmother who uses her iPad to use Woolworths online in regional Victoria. I mean, there is just a huge number of new customers that you would think would never have been attracted to online shopping that are now, you know, this is really embedded in how they live their life and how they shop. Obviously, the impact of that is going to be, well, how can, you know, supermarkets and food retailers do that in a really cost-effective way? We saw in Melbourne in the most recent lockdown, Coles having to close three separate stores to act as last mile fulfillment centres just to be able to keep up with demand. And so what it's going to do, it's really going to drive the creation of new dark stores for shopping centres and a lot of that cold storage space as well.
The second theme in the report is titled More Local, Less Global, and focuses on the fact that closed borders mean that the Australian and New Zealand economies and property markets will need to rely more on internal demand than demand from overseas. This is especially the case for residential and hotel demand. Also, an early impact of COVID-19 was the strain on supply chains as factories in China shut down. This has caused a rethink about diversification of supply chains and indeed suggestions that more goods need to be manufactured locally, which would buck the trend of a shrinking manufacturing sector over the past few decades. Kate, do you subscribe to the notion that there will be more manufacturing done locally?
I don't think I do, Bradley. Look, we definitely saw some really significant breakdowns in supply chain earlier on in the pandemic, and businesses have been sort of starting to move away from China in part because the increasing wage growth in that country and starting to look at diverse supply chain over the past 3 or 4 years. What we have been working with is a just-in-time inventory model where you would have just the amount of inventory you need and you'd be able to import more when you needed it. What we're probably going to see now is that groups will start to hold more inventory. So they'll be able to facilitate orders and make sure that they stay on top of it. So I think we'll probably start seeing groups really start to think about their supply chain and really start to, you know, stop any gaps they've got in there. But I don't think there's going to be a significant shift to local manufacturing anymore.
The closure of international borders and lower levels of migration are impacting demand for hotels and residential accommodation in Australia and New Zealand. It's unlikely that this will improve until at least the second half of 2021, with international borders expected to be partly closed or fully closed until then. Tamba, both Australia and New Zealand have benefited from higher levels of migration over recent years, particularly residential markets. But with lower migration, based on the fact that international borders will effectively be closed for much of 2021, what's the impact going to be for residential demand?
It's quite bad, isn't it? Demand for inner city and CBD apartments in Australia has been weaker because these apartments have traditionally been more popular with new residents. And with the border being closed, there haven't been any new residents to occupy those units. So they have been impacted with weaker demand. In New Zealand, it was a little bit different. So for us, COVID really started to have an impact at the end of March. And traditionally, February and March up till early March are our strongest take-up months. And that's when vacancy really goes down because we have a lot of people arriving into the country to start work or especially to study. And these are traditionally the occupiers of CBD apartments. So we had really low vacancy in mid-March. It did go up with COVID. It peaked in July at 5.4%, but that has come down to 4.6%. And that's really been enabled by a halt to rent growth. So rents have been reasonably flat during that time, which has allowed increasing affordability and a take up for occupancy. Little bit different with the pure student accommodation, though. So in Australia, the inner city rental market had fewer overseas students, which really impacted a vacancy rise in Sydney and Melbourne in particular. Same in Auckland. We've had closed borders, which has kept the international students here, but it's stopped new ones from coming into the country.
And how can developers respond to lower levels of demand due to lower migration?
Well, there's a lot of things that developers can do to respond to this, but they have already been building in resilience over the past few years just due to the changing development environment. So in Australia and New Zealand, stock has been proven to be quite resilient because it has been catering more to owner-occupiers than investors. Investors don't have strong demand in times of economic meltdown, but people always need somewhere to live, right? So owner-occupier demand is a lot more resilient than investor demand. And both in Australia and New Zealand, developers have been catering to that owner-occupier market more and more, with apartment living becoming more mainstream. So with the downsizer market in particular, the assets typically are larger in size and a higher quality build, and there is demand for that still. The CBD stock that hasn't pre-sold in Australia, they will find their selling conditions challenging. It's a little bit less of a concern for Auckland because we've had very limited CBD launches over the past few years, and we've got only 330 unsold CBD apartments. So less of a concern for us. But in Australia, If developers are wanting to clear stock, they will need to provide incentives to potential buyers. And that could be price discounts, although that's not recommended because it will annoy the people who already have apartments in that building. But there's other forms that we've seen come through in the commercial sector as well, with incentives such as rent-free periods when you sign up. In the long term, though, if pre-sale conditions remain challenging, there'll probably be a shift to build-to-rent. So build-to-rent is purpose-built rental accommodation. It does yield lower than build to sell, but it's also a lot more stable, and there's demand for rental much more than there is for ownership, given the high barriers to entry for ownership. In New Zealand, we have a lot of Kiwis looking to come home. 500,000 have indicated that they expect to come here in the next 2 or 3 years. So this is increased demand for housing, and in Auckland we've seen 15% house price growth in the last year, which is not what anyone expected given the economic environment, but it just goes to show the weight of demand.
The next section of the report is titled Recessionary Shift to Thrift, and this is basically looking into the impact on property markets that the fact that we are in an economic downturn is going to have. Unfortunately, the impact of recession and economic downturns is that businesses and households tighten their belts and they reduce spending. There remains an air of uncertainty regarding the speed of the economic recovery in 2021, and as a result, we're expecting office tenant demand will be weak and vacancy will rise. A question to you, Gergay. What strategies do you think that office occupiers will employ as they look to minimise costs over the coming 12 to 18 months? And do you see these as being short-term strategies or longer-term to permanent?
Look, Bradley, I think that some will be short term, some longer, or even permanent. But I guess the big question is how much some of those short term solutions will support companies' longer term strategies. And obviously, subleasing some of the excess space is one of the more obvious short term solutions. And we do see quite a lot of that happening in both Australian and New Zealand cities since the beginning of COVID. Now, leaving the CBD for cheaper, smaller, more suburban locations can also be part of the solution for some companies. And in New Zealand, AMP, who decided to leave the Auckland CBD, made big news back early on. But whether that will be their long-term solution, I'm not 100% sure. Obviously, even before pre-COVID, we have seen models which were supporting a smaller core CBD head office with spokes, you know, that's the hub and spoke model, with spoke offices in more suburban locations. That could be an option for some businesses. Or obviously, we can also look at the flexible space market, which has been booming before COVID. And we do think that it will, longer term, be an important part of many occupiers' model going forward. But I guess the important bit is that at this stage, currently, I think most of the businesses are in that impact analysis stage. So they haven't really made decisions regarding their portfolios, but are trying to understand what impact this change will mean on that portfolio. And in that regard, it's actually quite interesting to see in some of our reports that over 60% of participants indicated in one of the global reports that they are aggressively pursuing contraction and exit options. But at the same time, only about 30% of the companies indicated that they are highly confident in their ability to formulate a long-term strategy today. So I guess what businesses will need to be careful is that just to make sure that their short-term solutions, or what they think is a short-term solution, is not going to jeopardize their longer-term portfolio strategy.
And how do you think that landlords can facilitate this evolution, this change in workplace strategies?
I think landlords will need to address that through the offerings of their buildings. And the agile buildings is one example. And we have been talking about that a lot, even pre-COVID, that that new and modern office buildings will have different elements in addition to the traditional office space, whether that's event space or fitted short-term suites or co-working space or a concierge service that they offer to their tenants. All of these can be incorporated in buildings. Another really important topic, I think, for landlords to consider is any sustainability features that they can improve their buildings with, because increasingly both in Australia and New Zealand, sustainability will be and is an important consideration. In fact, in the latest Australian occupier survey, 90% of the participants indicated that that's one of the major and most important considerations when they look at a location or make locational decisions.
Thanks, Gege. Kate, in Australia this year, we've actually seen high levels of retail turnover, in spite of the fact that we've seen the economy basically contract in the first half of the year. The reason for this is a lot of people are working from home and they've upgraded their home offices and their backyards. And what that has translated to is actually strong retail turnover this year. However, the outlook, we think that given the fact that unemployment's probably going to rise to about 8% next year, that spending might be a little bit more conservative. So our base case is that retail turnover will be growing at a much lower level in 2021. So Kate, in preparation for, I guess, this lower levels of retail turnover, what can retailers and landlords look to do to reduce their costs?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Bradley. I think one really interesting thing about what we've seen in retail so far this year is that it really has been an acceleration of trends that we were already seeing anyway. We'd already seen that sort of mid-range fashion, fast fashion groups under a fair bit of pressure, really starting to, you know, look at their network and try and figure out where they need to be and where they don't need to be. And COVID's just really sort of accelerated that process. So going forward, how can groups reduce costs? The most obvious one, and we see it every downturn as well, it's really rationalizing your footprint and closing underperforming stores and putting investment back into high quality stores in high quality locations to really draw in customers and really, I guess, amplify your brand to the largest group that you can. Maximizing selling floor space is also really important. So why pay rent on space when you've got a whole bunch of that which is being used as backup? So now we know that a lot of groups are looking to, you know, create these spaces. I think Sneaker Boy in Melbourne is a really great example of that. They have 55 square metres of space in their CBD location, and 53 square metres of that is really active selling floor space. You go and purchase something on an iPad and that's sent to you later that day. And that's a really great way to be able to rent less space and really up your sales density from that. Without a doubt, the most expensive cost to landlords and occupiers going forward is going to be cleaning. Post-pandemic cleaning is exceptionally expensive. Coles have already flagged they're spending $100 million a quarter at the moment on cleaning. And you know, that filters down to smaller occupiers as well. So that is a need to have, not a nice to have. And so groups are really looking at ways now that they can provide this increased level of hygiene in a more cost-effective way. So whether that includes automation, whether that's, you know, push back at it on a centre level and how you can try and put some efficiencies in there.
And in regards to the residential sector, Tamba, do you see cost considerations impacting demand for tenants or owner-occupiers next year?
Yes, it will. It'll change preferences and behaviour for sure. We've seen, you know, a change in preferences and behaviour with the onset of COVID. Pretty quickly, people took stock of their financial situation and got their affairs in order. We saw very quickly a big increase in debt paid down, and there have been job losses. So in Australia, there's been a rise in unemployment. In New Zealand, we haven't really had a big rise in unemployment rate, but we have had 11,000 job losses net. When you've got job losses, that means households may need to sell their dwellings, particularly if they're a business owner who hasn't been able to access the wage subsidy scheme and they've got now lower turnover plus staff costs plus premises costs. That puts a lot of pressure on business owners and on their ability to pay a mortgage as well. For renters, if they lose their job, they might not be able to afford the rent, which means they might need to downsize into something more affordable, or if they're younger, maybe even move back home with mum and dad. So the build-to-rent sector is well set up to accommodate sharing, and potentially it could be a move from renters or homeowners departing space that single household occupies and then moving into a flatting type situation. Build-to-rent often has two-bedroom dwellings set at either end of the unit, which enables some element of privacy. And while the living and kitchen area might be reasonably compact, you've got this communal amenity that you can escape to, such as a full-size kitchen or kitchens With dining space to host friends, lounge, games rooms, movie rooms, co-working space. Build to rent is well set up to accommodate sharers, and this could help with rental affordability or for people who have had to give up home ownership for whatever reason.
It's been mooted that the relatively high cost of dwellings in Auckland, Sydney and Melbourne, in conjunction with the potential for white-collar employees to increasingly work from home, it might see people moving further from CBDs and preferring to live on urban fringes or even commuter towns. Is this a trend that you expect is going to materialise, Tamba?
Yeah, so there have been some surveys done, and in the Australian context, there'll certainly be instances where that occurs. So people might live further afield and commute to the CBD 2 or 3 days a week rather than 5, because if they live really far away, 5 is quite intolerable, but maybe 2 or 3 is manageable. This will support increased demand for residential property on the urban fringes, but we don't think that there'll be a mass exodus of residents from the inner and middle city locations, because these areas are highly desirable for their proximity to amenity and opportunities, not just work. So cities with residential locations close to the city, they stay expensive even in situations like this. And it really comes down to personal choice. Are you willing to trade off time with dwelling cost? So certain jobs do require face-to-face contact, and certain people desire face-to-face contact at work. So they will choose to be closer to work, even if it is more expensive. And in the Auckland context, think about Ponsonby. It's always going to be expensive. If you're waiting for people who live in Ponsonby to leave so you can buy a house for cheaper, it's not going to happen. Those people are not going to have an exodus to the outskirts of the city because they live in Ponsonby for reasons other than proximity to work. It's got bars, it's got nightlife, it's got opportunities, it's got shops, it's got everything you like, parks and things like that. So residential location choice is more than just proximity to employment. It's values and preferences, and that's what drives behaviour.
The fourth theme in our report is a healthier future. Social distancing is a term we've all become familiar with thanks to the COVID pandemic. In Australia, we're still seeing social distancing measures on public transport, in workplaces, restaurants, pubs, and in shops. Perspec barriers have become ubiquitous. A question for you, Kate. What are some of the social distancing measures that we've implemented in retail over the past 6 to 9 months?
I think I probably have a little bit of a different perspective to everybody in this podcast, because I'm based in Melbourne, which has obviously had a pretty significant second spike. And so, you know, the kind of idea, I guess, of how long will some of these measures be in place, I think to Melburnians, this is something that's really here to stay. And I talk to colleagues in different parts of Australia who are a bit more relaxed when it comes to things like social distancing. So again, I think it's probably going to depend on where you are, but we've seen sort of, I guess, dots on the floor about where you can stand, the number of people allowed into stores, and of course, Perspex everywhere, really. It has become a boon for Perspex producers at the moment. So whether that is at the point of sale, whether that's within restaurants and cafes and gyms, you know, we've seen a lot of those measures in place. And a lot of that, particularly in retail, might slow the spread of COVID, but it's not going to eliminate the spread of COVID. But what it can do is it will give consumers the confidence that they can go back out and spend and live their life like they were before. And that's going to be really crucial getting back to this sort of idea of COVID normal.
Kate, some of those measures that we've seen in the retail environment, those social distancing measures, do you think that these are going to be permanent, and once we've got past the COVID pandemic, which hopefully is sooner rather than later, that these measures are going to stay in place, or they'll quickly be removed just as quickly as they went up, really?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of probably that physical infrastructure that's been installed, so again, point of sale screens and that kind of thing, will probably remain in place. But it's going to be really interesting to see how customer behaviour shifts and whether people will still adhere to, you know, remaining a metre and a half apart while you wait in lines and that kind of thing. So I think most likely we'll see the actual physical infrastructure remain in the medium term. But, yeah, but human behaviour can change very quickly, I think, and we might start to see some people just, you know, moving around as they were pre-pandemic.
Thanks, everyone, for your great insight and discussion today. And thank you for listening to Talking Property with CBRE. To learn more about how changing human behaviours and accelerated trends are impacting real estate, look out for the release of our research report, Building Immunity Through Real Estate Post-2020. If you enjoyed the show and want to check out more, visit cbre.com.au/talking-property or subscribe through Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Until next time.